Hi again, and thanks for joining us for another Student Press Law Center podcast. I'm Frank Lamonti, the SPLC's Executive Director, and every month on the podcast, we talk to the experts and newsmakers about the latest developments affecting students' legal rights to gather and report news. This month, we're going to talk about obstacles in K-12 schools that keep kids and teachers from using Gmail and YouTube and other technology they're comfortable using every day at home. First, just a reminder that the SPLC has a wealth of information that should never be blocked on your school computer, available at www.splc.org, and that we're a nonprofit advocate for your rights, and we need your support to keep that advocacy alive and strong. Our guests on the SPLC podcast this month are helping call the public's attention to the growing gap between the technological haves and have-nots in public schools. If you go into some public schools today, like the ones out here in Fairfax, Virginia, you'll see kids incorporating iPads and smartphones into their everyday schoolwork, using the tools they'll be expected to know how to use when they get out into the professional world. But you'll see plenty of other places where old-school attitudes and policies are keeping a lot of the potential of the web locked up behind a password-protected firewall. Well, James Bosco and Keith Kruger are convinced that this old-school thinking may be holding back a generation of our kids, and they've helped put together a roadmap to bring every school into the 21st century, where the same videos and apps that the students learn from at home can be incorporated into the school day. Their new report is called Making Progress: Rethinking State and School District Policies Concerning Mobile Technologies and Social Media. There's a link to it on the SPLC website and on our blog. James Bosco is the lead author of that report. He's a professor emeritus of educational studies at Western Michigan University. He's got a PhD from Teachers College at Columbia, and for the past 25 years, he's been actively researching and publishing in the field of school reform. Keith Kruger is the CEO of the Consortium for School Networking in Washington, D.C., which is an advocacy group made up of school IT directors and the industry professionals who work with them. He's a veteran manager of nonprofit organizations who sits on the board of eSchool News and a number of other nonprofits that work at the intersection of schools and technology. I want to thank both of you for being with us, Jim Bosco and Keith Kruger. And Keith, get us started by telling us real quickly what is, first of all, the Consortium for School Networking, and explain the program that the consortium is running called Participatory Learning in Schools.
Sure. Thanks, Frank. Great to be here today. COSIN's been around for 20 years. We're a coalition, a professional association of school districts, and as you said, it's the folks in charge of technology that are our core members. And we really try to think not only what it means for an individual teacher or in an individual school, but how do we get systems like, as you mentioned, Fairfax, thinking about their policies, their leadership, their vision around what learning looks like today. Our real mission is around how does learning look like today in order to prepare kids for today and tomorrow. And it's not a lot like we need to keep what's good about the past, but we also need to – there are new opportunities with new tools. And the participatory learning work that we've been doing has been started with some funds or support by the MacArthur Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur. The reason, frankly, about 3 or 4 years ago, we were interested in, you know, how are school leaders thinking about collaborative tools, what social media, Web 2.0. And we approached them with the question of, do superintendents know about it? Do they support it? How do curriculum leaders at a district level, and how do our IT folks, are they using it? Do they know what it is? Do they know how it's used educationally? And are they actually doing it? And what we found, I think we perhaps had a hypothesis that perhaps superintendents and curriculum leaders might be behind in thinking about this. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was widespread consensus. Over 75% of all those careers accepted the premise that these collaborative tools have an important place in the future of learning. But when we scraped below the surface, there was very little of it being used, and in fact, as you said, in many places it's banned, largely because they think that under federal laws, the Children's Internet Protection Act, that they can't do these things.
Right.
So we thought that was an important time to have a different conversation.
Right, yeah, and we'll probably talk with Professor Pascoe a little more about SIPA as well, but of course that is a great oversimplification of SIPA, and in fact SIPA yeah. says nothing about, for example, banning social networking sites or Twitter or Gmail or anything like that. It's a much narrower law than a lot of the school technology people have been frightened to believe. Well, let's switch to Jim Bosco. I want you to have the bulk of our time to talk about the Making Progress Report, but just before we get started, start off by telling us how you came in your work and your research to have this focus on technology use in schools and why you think access to technology is a difference maker in learning.
Thanks, Frank. Delighted to be here. Well, as you pointed out, I'm a professor, but my career has not been spent in that illustrious ivory tower. My work has been really in schools through my entire career. I've worked in schools. I've been co-director of projects with in schools. So I've that's been the focus of my work. A lot of time spent talking to teachers, students, and trying to see how we can respond better to the needs of our kids. So in a sense, you know, the question of why technology and why these resources that we're talking about in this project and that COSET has been working with over the years is almost to me like asking an MD, if your work is focused on dealing with a particular medical problem, if someone comes up with a medication that really works effectively, why are you using it?
Right.
Really, the answer is, why wouldn't I use it? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really the that seems to me to be the more interesting question. I think the people who are using it in our schools, of course. Let me just quickly say that one of the things we've learned over the years through some painful experiences is. It is not what you use, it is how you use it. So that it is very clear that any of these resources, and starting with the first emergence of IT in schools, which was the personal computer, through the internet, through the web, through one-on-one, through social media, et cetera, none of these resources in and of themselves guarantee that we will change in significant ways the opportunities for our students to learn in our schools in and of themselves. So it's a question of how they're used. And I think it's really important to highlight something that Keith said in the question you asked about our project. The project is called Participatory Learning. So it is really about looking at a different orientation, a different perspective, a different manifestation of the way in which learning occurs in the classroom, which means not only the stuff we put into it and the techniques, the applications, whatever, whatever, but the way we think about learning, the way we think about the role of the teacher and of the student and of some of the policies that have been in place, which in far too many instances tie the hands of the best teachers we have who are well prepared to use these resources to substantially, not just incrementally and not just marginally, but to substantially improve the opportunities for learning of our kids. So, you know, my work in schools has been focused on how do we do a better job, and God knows we need to do that. And a lot of my education, Frank, I should say, I'm a parent. I have three sons, mm-hmm. and you know, yeah, I got my doctorate from Teachers College, but a lot of what I've learned also has come from being a parent and seeing what happened to my kids in schools and other kids in schools, and saying we can do a much better job. We're missing far too many kids. And I'm not just talking about the dropout kids. None of my kids dropped out of school. they were there, but they weren't there in their high school experience. So how do we reach them? How do we make education vibrant and so that so it's not, as we've had to do, kind of, you know, tying them to the chair in order for them to do these onerous things that they had to do or they as they perceived it, but really getting their involvement and making learning a part of their lives.
Well, I think, you know, you emphasize the phrase participatory learning. That's one of the reasons why we at SPLC were so excited about this report, so happy to have our name lent to it, is it is much beyond technology, much beyond can I bring my smartphone to class. It is about an attitudinal change that education is something that we do collaboratively with you. It's not something that we force upon you. It's not something that we try to trick you into. The whole idea that if we let students have a computer that can freely access the internet, that they're all going to run out and start Googling pornography, just sort of assumes the worst about kids. And frankly, you know, the kids understand that very well. They understand that when they're being treated like they're untrustworthy, it's because you don't trust them, and that has consequences as to the learning environment.
Exactly, and let me just say that, you know, the notion of participant, you've kind of pushed that metaphor just a bit, that term just a bit further. It is not, I don't think it really stretches it too far to say that in far too many instances, kids sitting in our classrooms, it is much more like a spectator sport than really a participant. You know, and yeah, sure, they're doing stuff, they're doing things. But in terms of being a participant in the way in which they might be on the ball field or on the soccer field or wherever, where they're really engaged in the activity, in far too few instances that is actually occurring. And anybody who goes into classrooms and who walks into a school where you have teachers and we have a school environment that understands how to do it right, you don't need a doctorate from anywhere in education to see that there is something exciting and good happening in that school.
Well, I want to ask you, because you do work with school administrators and with school IT directors, what are some of the reasons that you hear? What are some of the rationales, justifications that are being offered for why we won't let kids bring in their phones, bring in their iPads, use their own devices, have access to the online tools that they use every day at home?
Well, there's two fundamental reasons for it, and they're both understandable. One is that many teachers and administrators want to protect kids. I mean, they know that there are things on the, you know, they're aware of things that they can access, sites that they can access, which are not the kind of thing that should be in the lives of kids. They are aware of the fact that that there have been bad things done through social media. We have enough. Periodically, we get the story of some horrendous event that's occurred, and if you're a human being, you don't want that to happen to kids who are in your care. So, you know, that's understandable. And the other reason is it's also understandable that they want to protect the school district.
Right.
And no superintendent wants to be sitting in a school board meeting when you have parents coming in who are waging combat against the school district in terms of what's happened to a kid in their school that's involved some of these applications. So, you know, it's understandable. So the approach that has been the dominant approach has been to say what we have to do is we have to protect kids and protect the district by building a barricade, by building walls and keeping it out so that we can, be sure, of course you never can be, that they're not accessing bad stuff, in school. And let me just say here that while CIPA focuses, Children Internet Protection Act focuses on pornography, my sense is, just as an individual, that some of the things that kids can access on the web, other than pornography, some of the hate sites of kids,
sure.
I think that is even in some ways even worse than some of the porn sites. But of course, we don't want to go into either. So okay, so we say how do we stop that from occurring? And you know, the reasonable thing that you might come up with, well, let's make a law. You know,
mm-hmm.
let's write a law. In terms of what you can't see. And what's not available to you, or let's build a fence, i.e. a filter, and let's set that so stringently that we can be assured, impossible, but the hope, that nothing like that will happen in school, and so that if it does happen, if kids steer around it, when parents come screaming to the school board, we can say, well, now wait a minute, we had a policy in place that is ironclad, and unfortunately there was a crack in it, they got through, but nevertheless, we were doing everything that we could to protect kids. That's been the conventional approach. And both Keith and I have pointed out on many instances that one of the things that we're both, and you know, I think we're both somewhat surprised to see how see some of the changes that are occurring, and that we're beginning to move from that approach of saying let's just lock it down, to say that we have to look for other ways to protect kids, and ways which have a more enduring effect on them, rather than just saying we can be sure that between 9 and 3 they're safe, and then after 3 o'clock, who knows?
Right. Well, expand on that a little bit, because you do address this in the report, and I think it's
right.
important because it is driving a lot of the policy right now, is the concern about cyberbullying on social networking sites. So
right.
if building that wall, if erecting that fence is not the response, what's the more constructive and more effective response?
Yeah, well, and we have talked about moving from a policy which talks about acceptable use to responsible use.
Mm-hmm.
What that says is that the approach has to be where we're working with students, staff, teachers, everyone in the school district to develop ways to help educate kids, to help let them know that we are placing responsibility on them, so that they are learning how to monitor themselves and do the right thing. And so, for example, in the case of cyberbullying, some of the school districts we're working with are saying, "Hey, look, you know, so is the issue to only prevent bullying when it's cyberbullying?
Mm-hmm.
What happens on the playground?
Sure.
What happens in the school? So." What that means is they have to be willing to take on the probably somewhat bigger problem, but the right problem of saying it really is the social environment of the school, not just the social media. So that what we have to do is we have to have kids who treat each other in a decent way, and we have to do everything we can to see that that occurs through every aspect of the school that involves any social media that's being used. It involves a playground. It also involves what's happening in the classroom. When a kid says something and the other kids laugh at him, make fun of him, whatever. So, you know, that's the way I think the more enlightened school districts, and there are more and more of those, are approaching the problem.
Sure. Well, let's let Keith Krueger sort of give us some thoughts by way of wrap-up about how are you hoping that the Making Progress report is going to be used, and for the consortium, what are the next steps from here?
Well, I think this is a really important moment, and it's probably a conversation, you know, for the last 20 years, the way that we've really talked about technology in schools is we've started with the question of how do we, it really comes down to one word, and that's safety. Mm-hmm. And that's been the legal and policy environment. And so therefore you end up with the technology, as we've already discussed, where you create an educational ATM, where you have a couple things it can do and you lock it down as tightly as possible. But we really sense a big movement of change around educational leaders. And so this new document, I think, is a sort of a breakthrough in the sense that, you know, you have the state school boards, the school boards association, the principals, the superintendents, the teachers union, all coming together to really say, first of all, that we need to reconsider these sort of policies, and the banning is simply not the answer. You need to rewrite your acceptable use policies to really reflect the world that we live in. And this is an opportunity to really educate kids and to emphasize the professional development for teachers and administrators. The conversation you were just having about cyberbullying, I mean, as we like to say, there's bullying. Some of it happens electronically, some of it doesn't. And so you need to start with bullying. We also, when we're thinking about what learning looks like. And, there are some unique aspects about using a Facebook site. You probably need to understand as a teacher that if you're inviting kids into your personal Facebook site, you really can't control that. You don't know what others are posting to it, what jokes they're telling, what images they're putting up. So there is a big educational process. But when we start with the trusting students that, or the expectation that they become responsible citizens, that's really the world they live in. And, the way in which these sort of collaborative tools and the mobile aspect of life, I have to laugh. We had the Pew Internet and American Life Project did some surveys of school systems, and 85% can't use their cell phone in classes. Mm-hmm. And yet, when they asked whether or not you had a permissive policy or not, have you ever done texting in school? 58% said that even those that were in that had a ban, they were still doing texting in class. So sure. The policies we have don't match the reality. I think we have to just start leveraging the resources that kids have for learning. You know, more and more schools are saying that you can use your mobile device, you know, before or after or over lunch break, but we aren't leveraging that into the classroom. Conversely, school systems, only about 13% of classrooms in our country have a ubiquitous one-to-one environment. We're not using the technology that kids have. So, you know, you get to high school where over 50% of kids have a smartphone, and they're probably sharing a computer, you know, three or four kids to one computer.
Sure.
Isn't there a different way that we can do this?
So you're walking around with a better computer in your shirt pocket than the school probably has on the desktop, yeah.
you're locking it up in the locker or in the backpack. Yeah, and I think, while there are legal concerns that school boards and parents have, there's educational concerns that teachers and administrators and parents have, too, that I think we haven't exactly mentioned. One is that it'll be that if we allow kids to have mobile devices with Internet, they're going to be distracted or that they'll cheat. And I think we have to have a bigger conversation about that. First of all, there is a time to turn off devices. There is a time to focus on things. But what is cheating? You know, when I grew up, you had to memorize the state capitals. Well, now I can find a capital of anywhere in the world within about 20 seconds. Is that the right question to ask?
Right.
We have to ask different questions. And so countries like Norway are letting their high-stakes testing to be an open Internet test because you're going to ask different kinds of questions. Why is the capital of Norway Oslo? That isn't something that factually you have to make an argument. You have to do critical thinking. And so I think, you know, this is part of a bigger conversation of what does really learning look like.
That's such an interesting approach. Well, to take us out, I want to make sure that everybody has access to the Making Progress report. So give us the web address for the consortium so that if people want to come read it on your site, they can find it.
COSN.org/makingprogress. So it's pretty easy, and it's free and downloadable. And we hope that folks will use it to start a conversation. There are a number of consensus perspectives, and then there are suggestions for how to restart the conversation.
And there's another document on the website, the COSN website, too, that pertains to this that people might want to take a look at, and it's a document called Moving from Acceptable to Responsible Use. It's a guide that assists districts in rethinking their acceptable use policy, and that's also available on the COSN website.
Thanks. Right. I've seen that's a wonderful resource.
Yeah, and that's at cosn.org/AUP guide.
Terrific. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for both being with us today, Professor James Bosco of Western Michigan University and Keith Krueger of the Consortium on School Networking. You've started an important conversation about freeing up access to the information and the tools that students most want to use in their research. We hope everybody will take a minute to look at and share the entire Making Progress report. And we hope that if any of you are having problems with access to technology or with any question about your legal rights, you'll contact the Student Press Law Center. Many ways to do that. You can go through our website at www.splc.org. You can call our free attorney hotline. That's 703-807-1904. And our mailbox is always open at splc@splc.org. I want to thank you for supporting the Student Press Law Center, and thanks for listening.